From Altoona to Carlisle, Danville to Erie, this is a Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania's House of Representatives logged few legislative days in 2023, and now they don't plan on returning to session until March 18th. Our Capital Watch crew is here for a roundtable discussion on the reasons behind the light schedule. And the presidents of Harvard, Penn, and MIT sitting before a congressional committee and failing to condemn genocide against the Jewish people shocked the nation. I'll have a town hall commentary on what Pennsylvania lawmakers are doing to combat anti-Semitism. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. It's a new year, but the same old story with the Pennsylvania Turnpike. A 5% toll increase takes effect this week. The annual fare increases are the result of legislation passed back during the Rendell administration that has siphoned off hundreds of millions of dollars annually and given it to the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation and various transit agencies across the state. The amount of those transfers has recently been reduced from $450 million per year to $50 million annually, but the Turnpike Commission had to borrow money to make the legislatively mandated payments. It's now stuck with paying back those loans. As a result, expect annual fare increases until at least 2050. Governor Josh Shapiro, other executive branch officials, and state judges will all receive a 3.5% pay increase effective immediately. The annual cost of living increases occur as a result of legislation passed back in the 1990s to evade having lawmakers vote on future pay hikes. Another mid-state state senator has announced he will not be seeking re-election this year. Senator Mike Regan, who represents parts of Cumberland and York counties, says he will not seek a new term. He joined Senator John DeSanto of neighboring Dauphin County in announcing his retirement from the upper chamber. Regan's district is heavily Republican, but the registration advantage flipped to Democrats in the recent redistricting of DeSanto's district, giving Democrats a pickup opportunity. Republicans currently control the state Senate by a 28-22 margin. Speaking of the state Senate, the chamber met this past week and reelected State Senator Kim Ward of Westmoreland County as president pro tempore. That is the highest office in the Senate. Ward was first elected president pro tempore last year, becoming the first woman to hold the position. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The holidays are over, and most of us, it's back to work time, but not for the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, which doesn't plan on returning to session until late March. Here to discuss the lack of legislative activity is our Capital Watch crew. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capital Watch All-Stars, Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, great to see you.
Great to see you, Dave. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And also with us, my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to be with you.
Great to be with you, and Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to all, and thanks again to the listeners for being here and joining with us and kicking off yet another trip around the sun here at Sin City, Harrisburg, PA. And certainly in the early going here, Steve, that there's lots of nonsense to report on.
Well, you know, we talk about keeping an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome, and most folks, when we say Capitol Dome, they're thinking the big, tall dome over the center of the Capitol. And that's the most obvious and noticeable dome. But if you look at either end of the building, there's a dome over the Senate chamber on one end and a dome over the House chamber on the other. And the intrigue and confusion and drama seems to be playing out over there underneath the hall of the House, their dome. Mm-hmm. And apparently it's leaking. There's water coming in the dome. And so This is a relatively minor leak. We're told that it's been known about for some months, if not longer. But Pennsylvania's full-time legislature that normally would be meeting numerous times between now and the spring has determined over in the House chamber that because of the repairs needed to fix this leak, they're going to have to leave their jobs for about almost 3 months and not come into the chamber and not call House session except for one short day in the midst of all that until March 18th. Here we are, beginning of January. The House is going to simply not vote, debate, and take action on bills for almost 3 months.
Now, Steve, there wouldn't be any ulterior motive for that, would there be?
Well, yes, there would. We're talking about under the dome, and things happen under the dome. And it turns out that along with the leak, there was a retirement of a member on the Democratic side. The Democrats had a 102 to 101 majority in the House. With the absence of that member, until a special election can fill the seat, which will take place coincidentally in about 3 months. The Democrats have a majority, but it's now a 101-101 split on the floor. Mm-hmm. And if they bring the House into session, they're afraid that Republicans might do something that could somehow influence that majority or dispose of the current leadership or whatever might happen. So they're simply sending everyone home on the premise of a leak. Now, this is being done in 2024. We have a lot of technology. We have telephones and communication devices and computers and texts and all sorts of verification methods. But apparently, the democratically controlled House is not able to think creatively about how they could possibly operate if they couldn't get into their chamber for a few months. And if you think about this, this is any business that was operating or any private sector organization that was providing some sort of good or service. If they had a leak that actually prevented them from doing their work, they would do a workaround. They would figure out how can we continue to do the work we need to do on a temporary basis until the problem can be fixed. So if we pretend that the leak is a serious problem, how about maybe the House could meet in a nearby church or hotel or
the Forum Building.
Or the Forum Building. We're talking about 202 people and some staff. It's not that big of a crowd. It could be accommodated in multiple hotels around this region, gathering banquet spaces, churches. It's easy to find room of a room of that size where they can conduct their business and just comply with all the requirements, and they can do it. It happened in the past. In 1897, the Capitol burned down, and so the members of both chambers went down to a church on State Street in Harrisburg, just a block away, and had their sessions there. There's all sorts of things they could do if the leak was really preventing them. But as we noted, the Democratic leadership, it seems quite obvious from the scenario here, actually don't want to meet for the next 3 months.
Well, and so, I mean, Rebecca, to me, that there are two issues here. I mean, number one, obviously, there's the you know, abdication of responsibility of not meeting for months and leaving the public's business open during that time. But also, there's just the insult that comes from, you know, such a completely transparent just tissue of lies. Like, don't turn the hose on me and tell me that it's raining.
Right. I mean, I just think about this. And like you said, Steve, we're in 2024 now. And correct me if I'm wrong, but just 4 years ago, we had a pandemic, which was a major disruption to everybody's work. We in Pennsylvania were very affected by that because of the business closures, and the General Assembly continued to operate as well. It adopted rules that allowed remote voting, and you know, they worked around it when they wanted to.
Well, I mean, it goes to show that politics is more important than the actual, you know, conduct of the public's business, which is just extremely regrettable. But also, you know, just kind of gives you a benchmark on as to how things are going around here.
And this is a state of Pennsylvania is a large, important state. I mean, our state budget annually is somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 billion, billions of dollars of assets around the state. And Pennsylvania is an important state. We're a large economic power. We're talking about a state with an annual budget to the tune of $50 billion a year, more billions moving through federal funds and other funds that come into the state. You're talking about billions of dollars worth of property around the state that the state government is the steward of. And for them just to simply walk away from their jobs for 3 months in the midst of all that, when there are plenty of other options that could allow them to continue to meet, if in fact the leak is really so bad as they say. It's troublesome, and especially because Pennsylvania has a full-time legislature.
Right.
Most states don't even have a full-time legislature. Mm-hmm. Here we have one that exists. It's being paid, and one of the chambers is basically calling it in for 3 months.
Well, I'll
say— They just got a raise, too, didn't they?
I believe that they did.
Yes.
I believe that they did
and
with the turn of the
year. And a consequence of this, it impacts the Senate, too. Now, the Republican-controlled Senate, they don't have any leaks. Their chamber is functioning properly. But in our legislative system, in our system of representative democracy— The House and the Senate have to work together to send bills to the governor. The Senate can't send a bill to the governor on its own. Both chambers have to concur in the bill before it can go to the governor. So even the Senate is now blocked from doing their business because the state House has chosen not to do its business.
I just hope that there are a lot of constituencies out there, a lot of folks who are wanting to get things done this year in the legislature. They want bills to be passed. They want things to get done on both sides of the aisle and on lots of issues. And I hope those constituencies hold the legislature and the legislators accountable for the fact that things are not going to get done this year. And this is why.
The Democrats don't want to risk their majority. And so while the legislature is deadlocked, they're not going to come into session. Like, that's the truth. And to pretend otherwise is insulting. Oh, well. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. One of the things that has been entered into the public discourse, it was actually our senior senator, Bob Casey from Scranton, talking about inflation as being caused by greedy businesses. He calls it greedflation. And I got to say, this really sort of sticks in my craw for a number of reasons that I'd like to explain. First of all, if he's accusing businesses of price fixing, that's already illegal. And if he has proof of that, he should call the Department of Justice and get those employers in the dock, because that's illegal. If a business is failing to meet the needs of its customers, if a business is overcharging, that actually creates an opportunity for another business to come in, satisfy customers, and take that first company's market share away. And that's, again, that's how markets work. But in fact, what you see is prices going up because of inflation, higher energy prices, all sorts of other things, the workforce crisis, things that are putting pressure on costs for businesses. And so the argument is that because a certain product has gone up at a rate higher than the average rate of inflation, that somehow that's price gouging. Well, that's completely silly. These politicians have no idea what goes into somebody's business operations or what the different inputs are. And again, there's also with higher energy prices and with inflation that there's a layering with the increase of costs at every step of production, and that this is what has been causing employers to have to raise prices. And so I think it also bugs me because, again, in years when businesses are not doing well, when they're not profitable, maybe they're even losing money, that there's very little interest or concern on the part of our political leaders. But when there's a situation like we have now, where everybody is feeling the pinch of higher costs of living due to, you know, again, the Biden administration lighting the fuse on inflation with the $1 trillion spend in April of 2021, which, again, Senator Casey voted for, you know, that it's that kind of government greed. They spent more because they had the power to do it. Even though it wasn't good for the economy, it was good for their respective political constituencies that they were buying off with new spending, and that's why they did it. It's like the greed of government to take first, to act as though every single dollar that you and I and everybody else earns that belongs to the government first, and if they happen to let us keep any of it, well, that's just great, you know, great mercy and generosity on their part. And that the government is never held to account for wastage, for inefficiency, for, again, just chucking away money with both hands like there's no tomorrow. And so for them to accuse others of greed just strikes me as being really out of line.
And as you look at history, for the most part, the places where inflation has been the worst around the world throughout the duration of, let's say, recent history, the last 200 years, it's places where the government tends to intervene in the market.
Correct.
Where they are authoritarian in some sense or operating with policies that are very bold in terms of telling people what they can have, what they can buy, what they can sell, and what the price has to be. Those are the conditions that drown out the normal signals that the price system sends to manufacturers all around the world to either make something, more of it or less of it, in order to satisfy the market equilibrium. But when these interventionist governments step in, they mess up that system, they drown out the price signal, and people really don't know what to do, and you start to have a very inefficient production of goods and services and inefficient distribution. In those situations where inflation starts to rise, and we've seen it especially in the South American countries, in the African countries where there have been very, if not outright corrupt, at least very stifling governments, you see the inflation rates rising into the tens, the hundreds, even the thousands of percentages.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember when I was serving in the Pennsylvania State House, one of my colleagues handed me a $2 million bill from the country of Zimbabwe.
Yes.
It was real. It wasn't fake. It wasn't a joke. The inflation had gotten so bad that they had to print $2 million bills for people to carry around in their wallets. And that's what happens when we get governments intervening into markets in an inefficient manner that drives these odd scenarios that would never happen in a truly free market.
Right. And you've seen what happened in Venezuela, that Hugo Chavez and his dictatorship there, that they took one of the wealthiest countries in Latin America and that they have reduced it to absolute poverty.
It's in the sectors that the government is most involved in that we've seen costs rise the highest over the past couple of decades in the United States. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that graph of, I mean, we can't talk about graphs on the radio much, but if you've ever seen that graph that shows costs going up and down.
Over time.
And the red lines that showed the costs going exponentially up over time were all in the sectors like healthcare, education, housing, all of the sectors where the government is the most involved.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve's absolutely right. It's those sectors where the market indicators, the market forces that drive prices back to equilibrium or back to normalcy is where we really drive that inflation. And that affects all other aspects of the economy too.
And it just bugs me. These people, you know, the people who have the attitude that somehow, more government is always better. And the more government spends, the more government is helping. It's like, well, no, there's no proof behind that at all. And yet somehow that is the unchallenged assumption of all of our public policy debates, that somehow inherently more government involvement makes things better, more government spending makes things better. It's like, well, no, actually there's huge opportunity costs that go along with all of those things, and that sometimes the thing that would be best would be just to stand pat, do nothing, and let people find their own solutions and let the market work things out.
Right. I mean, millions of small choices and decisions that are made throughout the market every single day will drive to better solutions for everybody than the government making decisions. There's no doubt about that. It's been proven time and time again throughout history.
There are certainly some areas where it's appropriate for the government to intervene. Like we can't raise the United States military system through the private sector.
Absolutely.
We need a defensive,
limited constitutional government.
Right. A defensive military force in place ready to protect ourselves. It's
right.
A dangerous world. When it comes to building certain types of projects, there are things that are public goods that really no private sector entity has the wherewithal to erect on its own.
Correct.
Right.
And so there's a place for government.
Sure,
I'm not saying government
Agreed.
Should not intervene at all, but it should be, as Rebecca said, as minimal as possible and only when absolutely necessary to correct some sort of illegal conduct.
Right. And again, it goes back to the whole structure of American government. It's all premised on that the government is only allowed to do those things that it is expressly empowered to do by the Constitution and the law. And but just as the decades have rolled on, that we're at the point now where it seems as though that government will do to you whatever you can't stop it from doing, which of course is the complete inverse of how our system is supposed to work. And I just – that for these big government interventionists who are always the first ones to seize more power, more money out of the private economy, more control away from people's lives, for them to accuse others of being greedy, well, I mean that just doesn't pass the laugh test.
And we've seen this kind of behavior. It's not all that rare even. But in the United States, we've been fortunate over the centuries for the most part to realize that a free market is the basis for our strength and our continued growth and influence. If we get away from that, we risk making ourselves weaker and really giving the next generation a less optimistic chance at success.
And we're already in bad shape with annual budget deficits of over $1 trillion and rising. We have a national debt which is now over 100% of gross national product, and annual interest payments on the money that we've already borrowed going over $1 trillion. So basically, when you're in a hole, stop digging. And you know the people who are the politicians should look on the productive sector as being the actual strength of our economy and society, and call off the dogs. So anyway, that's enough out of me. We're down to the end of our time as ever, guys. Thanks for being on the program here, Steve. Where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the stuff that you're doing?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org.
Outstanding. Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about you?
The Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association is at pmta.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks to all of you for listening. We will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. The spectacle of the once prestigious University of Pennsylvania's president squirming before a congressional committee, trying to walk a tightrope between moral certitude and adherence to the speech codes that dominate higher education, shocked the nation. Despite repeated opportunities to admit genocide of the Jewish people would be a violation of university policy, now former Penn President Liz McGill could not bring herself to state the obvious. Her equivocation, echoed by the presidents of Harvard and MIT, provided a rare glimpse into the institutional rot that has pervaded the nation's colleges and universities. In Pennsylvania, gridlocked this past year by a partisan legislative divide, McGill proved to be a unifying force. Democrat Governor Josh Shapiro was among the first to denounce her performance and was quickly joined by lawmakers from both parties. The Pennsylvania State University, not to be confused with Penn State, is one of four so-called state-related universities, the others being the University of Pittsburgh, Lincoln University, and Temple University, which receive partial funding from the Commonwealth. The University of Pennsylvania, along with the other three state-related universities, already was under the legislative microscope before the genocide controversy. The state's annual appropriation to the universities was withheld for 6 months due to concerns over transparency and accountability of taxpayer funds. The Pennsylvania Freedom Caucus, a group of conservative state house lawmakers, had already been waging a battle against the state-related universities for the suppression of conservative speech, among other issues. In March of last year, State Representative Joe DiOrsi of York County, who sits on the House Education Committee, submitted legislation to ban free speech bias against conservative students and speakers. Back in October, as the funding battle continued, the Freedom Caucus even warned against a troubling rise in campus anti-Semitism. McGill's performance in front of the Congressional Committee exploring anti-Semitism on college campuses proved the Freedom Caucus's point. Her attempts to defend radicals on her campus calling for Jewish genocide on free speech grounds, or as she put it, context-dependent, laid bare the university's moral decay and pervasive institutional ideological discrimination. Fallout over the issue resulted in the State House denying funding to the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. That $33 million appropriation was put to a vote shortly before Christmas and failed to gain the two-thirds majority vote needed to approve the funding. House Republican leaders sent Penn's interim president a letter outlining what must now happen to receive the funding, in addition to stating unequivocally that calls for Jewish genocide violate the university's code of conduct. The university must support a package of bills introduced at the end of the year designed to combat anti-Semitism at both the basic and higher education levels, and support a discussion of free speech issues currently under consideration in the legislature. In announcing the legislation, State Representative Aaron Coffer of Luzerne County lamented, quote, "It is hard to believe that in 2023 we have to say that genocide against the Jewish population or any religious group is wrong. The rise of anti-Semitism in our systems of education, both at the primary and higher levels, must be stopped, period," end quote. Among the legislative proposals is a bill sponsored by State Representative Rob Mercury of Allegheny County that would require institutions of higher learning receiving state taxpayer support recognize anti-Semitism and calls for the genocide of the Jewish people as bullying, harassment, and intimidation as part of the institution's code of conduct. Mercury said, quote, "Taxpayer funding should only follow with the university's commitment to combat anti-Semitic behavior and demonstrate leadership on campus by clearly identifying calls for genocide as against the code of conduct," end quote. In a news release, Representative Kristen Marcel of Bucks County noted that a recent survey in The Economist showed that 1 in 5 young people believe the Holocaust is a myth. She is sponsoring legislation requiring curriculum transparency in Holocaust education occurring in schools and noted that parents and the community deserve to know how these events are being taught. While all of this represents only the first steps on the long road to addressing pervasive anti-Semitic left-wing rot that has infected our nation's institutions of higher learning, Guy Shiraki of the Commonwealth Foundation pointed out, quote, "The root cause is the morally vacant, anti-liberal mindset that permeates Penn, produces graduates who become teachers and professors and civic media and business leaders. McGill didn't misrepresent Penn's values. She stated them loudly, clearly, and repeatedly." He concluded, "The reality, I hope, is that America revolted against not merely McGill's words, but against Penn's values," end quote. Values, or lack thereof, now revealed for all to see as prevalent on university campuses across the nation. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 29 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WJSM-FM in Martinsburg, WQZS-FM in Myersdale, along with WKVE-FM in Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.